Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Sneha Navarapu, the host of this channel. Today, I'm in conversation with Dr. Juan Del Nido, author of the brand new book, Taxi vs. Uber, Courts, Markets, and Technology in Buenos Aires. This book was published by Stanford University Press in 2021. Dr. Del Nido is a postdoctoral research associate in the Department of Social Anthropology at University of Cambridge. Hi. Welcome, Juan, to New Books. Congratulations on your fantastic new book, and it's just so wonderful to have you here.
Hi, Sneha. Thank you for having me, and thank you for the compliment.
Yeah. So let's start off this interview and this conversation with learning a little bit about you. Tell us a bit about yourself and your academic journey. What drew you to anthropology in particular?
Yeah, so it was a bit of a contorted journey because I started off as an economist. My first degree was economics, which I did back in Buenos Aires, which is my hometown. And I did various things for, you know, jobs and stuff. And it got to the point where I had this curiosity, you know, these sort of questions about social problems that economics wasn't really giving me exciting or relevant answers, or at least answers that I found relevant. So, yes, I discovered anthropology when I was 24 years old, and I did my master's, and I started out working with identity and nationalism and stuff. And then from then on, I moved on to a PhD, and then anthropology became my sort of intellectual home as a way of thinking about problems.
Yeah. You know, it's I've done a bunch of these interviews with anthropologists, but I've never actually heard a story of an economist becoming an anthropologist. So this is really interesting.
Yeah, it's a bit of a strange journey. I'm also the only economist that I know that then changed to anthropology. But it was a very productive journey, I'd like to think.
Yeah, I mean, if the book is symptomatic of that journey, I mean, it says a lot about your grasp, I think, on both the disciplines. That's great. So how did research for this particular book begin? What's the story behind this book?
Yes, so I was quite eager to do research in Argentina, and in particular in Buenos Aires, or in the Argentina that people in Buenos Aires know. I started off working with taxi drivers, which are fascinating, as in many big cities in the world, you know, Jakarta, London, Rio, Johannesburg, Istanbul, New York. There's this sort of iconicity, this urban excitement or urban charisma about taxi drivers, right? So I set off to study the industrial organization and, you know, the union and how the trade was run and how they made movement happen. And halfway through my fieldwork, Uber arrived, which was, from an intellectual perspective, it was a godsend because it was, you know, the conflict began to exist as such, right as I was studying the very industry that would come to be disrupted. And so as the conflict wore on and it was playing out on courts and on streets and social media and traditional media, I became less interested in a way, although the book is, you know, in a way also about them, but I became less interested in Uber itself and the taxis themselves, and more interested in the conflict that was entwining them, right? In the way Buenos Aires society and a particular segment of that society was making sense of what was happening, of, you know, political, cultural, economic, infrastructural problems, right? So I started tracing those threads, and they sort of built up to a pattern, and that pattern became the book as an attempt to figure out how a particular way of reasoning, as it were, which I call post-political, developed around the conflict.
Yeah, and, you know, as an ethnographer myself, that to an ethnographer in what I consider my hometown, I really cherished your thoughtful and candid discussion of your methods and your focus on what it means to do ethnography at home. So could you take us through some of the dilemmas you thought through while doing ethnography in Argentina, and like how did your study pan out over time?
It was fascinating in terms of methods and in terms of thinking about, you know, research, something that is very close, you know, to me. Home in a geographical sense, but also home in an intellectual sense, in a bodily sense, because the taxi industry, which is how this began, is in Buenos Aires, like in most places around the world, is a very gendered space geared towards men and, or, you know, or sort of the way the ways in which they interact with each other, their organizations, the union. Is a very, I mean, some of the critics refer to them as very phallocratic, you know, to give a sense of the dimension of how marked these spaces are, right? And it was also, you know, I am from a very middle-class background, and, you know, the taxi industry, although they're not, you know, they're not poor or they're not, necessarily quote-unquote working class, because many of them lead very comfortable lives, there was this tension, this class tension between how they saw me as a sort of posh you know, researcher coming from, you know, from the world outside of Argentina, as it were, going back to study, you know, them, and so that was one of the main difficulties, right? Because then I had to figure out how to talk about people who were, you know, they were also men, and my ethnographic participation in their spaces was allowed because I was a man and they recognized me as a man and I identified as a man and such, with the whole sort of gendered performance of being a man, right, in a place like Buenos Aires. But then, you know, as our interactions became more complicated during, you know, with Uber's arrival and stuff, intellectual cleavage started playing out as well, because I started recognizing patterns of thinking that I knew from my time as an economist, right? And that was also, in a way, home to me. You know, the ways of thinking, the ways of reasoning and making sense of things, of calling them same or different, as it were. So then, you know, my being in Buenos Aires was transected by all these sort of gendered class and intellectual dimensions that were actually quite complicated, and that I sort of started thinking, okay, how does my being here, right, as opposed to any other Argentine, what can I contribute from this position, right? We all have a position. And I think one of the main things that I found was, as opposed to disavowing it or, you know, or lamenting one's positionality, I think it was important to see what one can gain from it, right? And put it in a position where one can put oneself in a position where you can sort of, you know, what can I tell others, right? What am I well-placed to tell others from these positionalities that others maybe would struggle, you know, in the ways that I would struggle to, you know, to tell other stories, as it were. But it was a riveting, it was a fascinating experience because there were a lot of tensions between sameness and difference, and forced me to think in less obvious ways about what home meant, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I also really enjoyed you writing about how the drivers would, they knew that you weren't a taxi driver, you know, and like, I think that acknowledgement of the difference, even from their end, not just about class or gender, but also about, I guess, one's embodied knowledge of the trade. And the way you write about that, I thought was very interesting as well. That's great.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome because one of my main interlocutors, a fantastic guy, an immensely intelligent man as well, one of the first things he told me was, and I think it is in the book in the beginning, you will know a lot about the taxi industry,
yeah,
but you will never be a taxi driver.
Right? Yeah, that's exactly the one that I was thinking of. Yeah.
And it was really interesting because it forced me to think, you know, we share a language, we share a country, we share a disposition towards understanding this conflict in terms that matter to them. But then the question became, how do we make those differences productive? And it was interesting to me to think in terms of there's long discussion already in you know, ethnography and discussions of method of this cognitive complicity, right? Which basically means, you know, trying to think through your difference with the frankness that matters to understanding the problems that the other part has, as it were, in the terms that matter to them, right? That was a particularly productive encounter, I would say.
Yeah, it was ethnographic gold. So the book at its core is examining the clash or the several clashes between taxis and Uber that followed the launch of Uber in Buenos Aires in 2016. I found it so useful that you mentioned at the outset that the book is not really about taxis or about Ubers, but it is tracing the various arguments that constituted this very clash and what that clash can then tell us about globalist, culturally liberal middle classes in Argentina. And the book obviously does so much more and proposes a theory, what you refer to as post-political reasoning, and I want to get into all of that. But I was hoping that we could start with you giving us a bit of historical context about the rise of the Argentinian middle class and how you think about the middle class in your own work. So who is the middle class in Argentina and how are they historically situated?
Yes, so Argentina, and particularly as Argentines understand Argentina, is a bit of a peculiar country because it went from being a colonial backwater of the Spanish Empire, right, at the southernmost tip of South America, and a fairly comparatively irrelevant land, irrelevant to Europeans, of course. It was populated for millennia by Native American peoples. But it was only after independence, which in Argentina was, you know, between 1810 and 1816, depending on which date one takes, that the country became sort of reorganized around agricultural capitalism, for which it was exceptionally endowed, as it were, with fertile land and, you know, vast lands that were taken from those peoples. And as the country inserted itself in those patterns of agricultural capitalism, there was this spectacular economic rise. It was a wealthy and prosperous country, politically violent, but economically prosperous towards the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century. And sort of during that time, a national imaginary consolidated around a national history of progress, of technical progress, right? Of a sort of a positivistic view of the world that Argentines had conquered. Argentina was at the time wealthier than most European nations, one of the wealthiest countries in the world as people knew it back then. And with that came an explosion of immigration, particularly in central Argentina, which is where Buenos Aires is, from central and southern Europe, but also from the Middle East, all the way up to Russia, etc. So all of these immigrants started building up to a middle class, incorporated via a welfare state developed mostly by Perón, known for, you know, it's fairly known in the world, but one of Argentina's most salient political and party leaders in the early 20th century. So we're talking about a middle class that sort of grew as it sees itself, right, on a history of progress, of striving, of positivistic, with a positivistic view of the world, as it were. And as the 20th century unfolded, Argentina became, for reasons that are, deserve a much greater exploration that we may have time for, Argentina became a politically more polarized, economically more marginal country. Production stalled, became monetarily very unstable. And so these middle classes started sort of fractioning themselves politically and economically. Of course, I'm not saying they were always homogenous, but the story became quite more complicated because we're talking about a people that started struggling with the idea that they belonged in an impoverishing nation as opposed to a poor one or a rich one, right? And this middle class, which still exists, you know, it's a very strong segment of Buenos Aires society in particular today, has this anxiety for that modernity, for that progress, or for whatever they imagine, right, is associated with that modernity and that progress. That is a longing to belong to what they see as the world, as the modern world. And so it's a very, it's a very subtle sense because this is not a, it's not a libertarian middle class, but it's a middle class that longs for and deploys a discourse of personal choice and personal freedom. It's a superficially ecumenic class, by which I mean this is a class that defines itself as tolerant, as progressive in the contemporary sense of the term, as politically inclusive, and is quite anxious to perform that as well. Is very, or likes to think of itself as cosmopolitan and sort of attuned to what's happening in the world. So this is the middle class. This is the segment of the Buenos Aires middle class that dominated the reasoning about the Uber conflict, right? And that defined to a great extent how the conflict played out across all its fronts, right? On social media, at courts, and on the streets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was very, very helpful. Thank you. And I realize that it's actually quite difficult to squeeze like a very complex history into a podcast answer, but I think this was great. Thank you for that. So the first three chapters delve into, as you put it, what the taxi industry and transactions are like in Buenos Aires, what kinds of bodies and knowledges they are made of, and how they belonged in the common experience before Uber arrived. And the first of these chapters looks at the role of the taxi license and a murder in 2001 in making possible taxi driving as a public service. So could you elaborate on this and tell us the story of the political drama unfolding around the seemingly benign taxi license?
Yeah, it was a riveting story, and part of which I remembered as a citizen of Buenos Aires because I was living there when all of these things happened. But taxi driving, one of the difficulties that I had with the book and that anyone working with taxis will have is that the word taxi is quite universal across languages, but it usually, it means usually very specific things in different places. In particular, in Buenos Aires, taxis are, there's only one kind of taxi. It's a four-wheeled vehicle, yellow on top, black at the bottom. And all licenses, the trade is organized by the state, of the city of Buenos Aires, the government of the city of Buenos Aires, and all licenses in principle and legally belong to the state. Now, since the 80s, which is as far as my interlocutors remembered and had been in the trade, right? So since the 80s and up until the late 1990s, it was an immensely informal trade. And informality in Argentina tends to take a particular form, which means that the taxis themselves were registered with the state, as was the license, but the people driving them were not. This is to say that people who owned taxis rented out the car to other people without telling the state that they were doing so in order to avoid labor charges and union charges and such, because of course, I should have said before, Argentina is a relatively highly unionized country in the mid-20th century sense of unions, and the taxi and the union of taxi drivers was particularly strong. Now, towards the end of the 1990s, this was one of the most informal trades in the city. Very few taxi drivers were registered as such, right? And then, so the license existed and was there, but was not doing the work that it was set up to do, which was render legal, economic, and labor relationships intelligible to the state and to passengers. In 2001, amid the general economic disintegration of Argentina, which led to the crisis in that's sort of known around the world in late December 2001. So we're talking about an industry that was losing trade because people didn't have any money. Two quote-unquote fake taxi drivers, that is to say two drivers who were not registered with the state as driving taxis, attacked two different women. One was also raped. Both of them were robbed and one was raped. And so that already put the subject of informality in the taxi industry on the news. We're talking about 2001. And in November, the husband of a famous Argentine celebrity was murdered in the back of a taxi in the same form of informality. To rob him. It was then determined that the robbery had been at random. It just happened to be the husband of someone famous. And because he was someone so famous, the case made national headlines. And at the time, the union leader, Omar Viviani, an immensely astute, charismatic leader, grabbed this momentum, right? And so he came out and said, well, it's not acceptable that us taxi drivers are being blamed for uniquely, solely blamed for these crimes. There has to be a responsibility shared by those who drive the taxi and those who own the taxi. And incidentally, the union had presented a project of law requiring precisely the end of informality in the taxi industry. And so during that summer, January, February 2002, which is, of course, summer in Argentina, the entire trade was reinvented by formalizing all of these labor relations. And somehow we ended up with one of the most formalized trades in what remains, in many ways, an informal city. And so this is how, because of that murder and because of the economic moment of the nation, because people were afraid of taking taxis, but also they didn't even have any money to take taxis, this union leader managed to craft a political economy for his trade, ironically, by making the license do what it always was supposed to do, which was link bodies to each other and to the state and render transport legible to the eyes of the public and of the state. And that's how the taxi industry came to be, as we know it today in Buenos Aires.
Yeah. And, you know, following, I guess, a thread of perhaps unintended consequences, the second chapter demonstrates so lucidly and provocatively how a road accident in 2013 enabled the rendering of the taxi driver body as a social problem. And you title this chapter An Intractable Question, which says a lot about the point that you're trying to make in the chapter about how a variety of social actors are trying to answer a question or solve a problem that has no real answer or solution. So what does tailing the various argumentations following this road accident in 2013 tell us about the politics of knowledge production in Buenos Aires?
I think it was a particularly apt example, as you say, to think about exactly as you put it, about the politics of knowledge. So in 2013, a young woman was out on the streets. She was going to cash a check, and in central Buenos Aires, in one of the main avenues, and a rogue taxi was suddenly out of control, crashed several vehicles on its way in one of the main avenues in Buenos Aires, and hurt several pedestrians and killed this woman. She was in her early 20s. Leonela Noble was her name. And so this was, you know, it was quite dramatic because it was all very, it was all cinematic, the entire accident. But also very quickly, when it came to figuring out, you know, whether it was homicide, manslaughter, and how to understand the conditions or the circumstances in which Leonela Noble was killed, in order to figure out that, they had to figure out, of course, what had happened to the driver. Now, the driver was found in the car with an unwrapped suit clenched tight in his fist. Then it came out that he was hypoglycemic. He was diabetic, which he knew at the moment of, you know, getting a taxi driving license, but he never told authorities. So then this triggered this fantastic legal case, trying to figure out, you know, was a problem that he knew and that he lied? Was a problem that he was diabetic, but he wasn't caring for it properly? What was the role of public institutions, the state, the taxi union, and other, you know, taxi owners' chambers, in knowing these bodies and what's happening with them? And it's very difficult because, you know, we're talking about 36,000 taxis driving around Buenos Aires at any given moment. So we're talking about 36,000 drivers in motion on their own in a car. Yeah. So then the question became, it was a huge PR problem even, right? Because, you know, people were very angry that how was this allowed to happen? But it was also, what was interesting about the accident and the circumstances of the accident is that it forced the question, presented the union and the government, the question of, how can we make sure this doesn't happen again, right? Of course, in order to know that someone who's alone driving in a car doesn't have an accident, you know, it's a very complicated question to ask because it amounts to asking, how do we know how bodies will behave on their own, which is tantamount to saying, how do we know that which we cannot know, right? So the entire chapter, in a way, sort of traces all the problematization, as it were, in the Foucauldian sense of the word, that is, the rendering visible of these bodies to particularize and in particular terms, in other ways, to know them in specific ways, right, through visual acuity tests, through audiometries, through psychological examinations, through classes where they get to discuss road safety and all of these matters, in order to instill in them a sense of, you know, a sense of sort of an ethics of driving, but also in order to read these bodies in specific ways. Can they tell red from green? Do they understand how, you know, high blood pressure affects them? Can they make a link between, you know, poor nutrition and hypertension, for example, right? And what was very interesting about you know, what followed the accident was, as you say, the emergent politics of knowledge, whereas as these bodies came to be known in a certain way, of course, seeing whether someone can tell red from green does not necessarily mean that that person is never going to, you know, cross a red light, right? It does not necessarily mean that they will never have an accident. But it's at least a way of approximating an answer, you know, to the question of how do we know? That's the intractable question. How do we know that which we cannot know, right? But what matters to me, what is crucial to me that we all get from this particular chapter is that this politics of knowledge is a public problem, right? The taxi industry, this is a public in the sense that it concerns everyone that moves in the city, right? It's not a problem about personal experiences, although it can be rendered as such, but it's fundamentally about how we all know each other and who has this knowledge and who has the right and why to pronounce themselves, to approximate an answer, right, to that question, to that intractable question. Why should it matter that an ophthalmologist pronounces herself with respect to a body, right, a particular taxi driver's body? Why should it matter that a road technician should prepare exams to make sure that future taxi drivers understand the codes of the road, right? So what I thought was really interesting about the taxi industry, especially in light of the conflict that would then unfold with Uber and a teeming discourse of public and private, was that these ways of knowing are public, are hierarchical, and in a way they are political because they prioritize answers, right? It matters that it is an ophthalmologist and not me as an ethnographer or as a regular person that pronounces herself over whether someone can see colors or not, right? It matters that is a road technician that makes sure that people understand these things. But it matters because, you know, these professions are embedded in a public problem of how we know each other, right? In the way in which we veto each other's knowledge, in the way in which we sanction each other's knowledge, in the way in which the judge looking at a case has to decide what is known about this person and why do we know what we do or not know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
So in the fourth chapter, you address Uber's arrival on this fractious transportation landscape in Buenos Aires. In this chapter, you show how the middle class mobilized a narrative that the people want Uber. And you write that this discursive strategy is best understood through what you term gladiatorial truths. So how are you conceptualizing this fascinating phrase, and what do these truths do to public discourse in Buenos Aires? Could you give us a few examples, perhaps?
Yes. So by that point in the book, Uber has already arrived, right? Obviously, as is implied in the question. And what was riveting to me to see was that somehow, you know, right after Uber arrived, the taxi industry initiated legal action against it at court. You know, another public way of deciding, you know, who belongs or not in the order of things of Buenos Aires, as it were. But simultaneously, amongst that middle class that we spoke of earlier, that, you know, cosmopolitan, anxious for modernity, middle class, developed, you know, quite strongly this notion that the people wanted Uber, and that therefore they should have it, right? Because they wanted it, right? And what struck me there was the immense traction that in late capitalism around the world, an argument based on what the people want has, right? And that's where I started thinking, how is this working? And it reminded me a lot of those stories about gladiators when they're fighting. And then, you know, at the end of the fight, Caesar has to, you know, either, you know, thumbs up or thumbs down, depending on what the people say. And that's the end of it, right? So that's where I developed this notion of a gladiatorial truth, which is, in a nutshell, is a truth claim, right? A claim to the stakes based on the moral legitimacy of what the people want, quote unquote, right? Because I think what's really interesting to capture here is that whenever this notion of the people want this or that, or the people think that, or the people feel that as a collective, whenever that's evoked, which is happening daily, right? Anytime you open the news, you see it everywhere. What's interesting to me is there's this notion sort of evokes a transfer, sort of a translocation of a problem. That a problem that was political, right? How does Uber belong in the order of things of Buenos Aires in this case? It transforms it into a moral problem. Because in this day and age, the people have come to be the site of what feels like this mystical moral legitimacy that it's increasingly difficult to argue against, right? Regardless of the context, it's a rhetorical drive that trumps parties, that trumps institutions, that trumps experts of any kind, regardless of how we feel about the particular claim that's being put forward. Right, it evokes a sort of a raw legitimacy based on consumers' choice, based on, you know, the people know what they want and know what is right for them, which is a very, you know, which is one of the core tenets of neoclassical economics, nowadays known mostly as neoliberalism, right? And I found it fascinating, and I was particularly struck and a little concerned by how difficult it is to effectively argue against it, right? Because, you know, amongst academics in our seminars, in our books, we can all say, you know, this should not be, you know, this is a more complex issue, this should be dealt with carefully, or, you know, there are many layers that one can't simply understand like that. But once in public discourse, right, once someone evokes what the people want, or what the people feel, whether through polls or, in my case, through the sheer excitement in the streets, it becomes quite difficult to effectively argue against it, right? It becomes difficult to repoliticize the problem, right? So the main argument here, and I think my main concern with gladiatorial truths, is that they turn political problems based on, you know, on our human capacity to disagree, right? They turn them into moral problems, where disagreement is not so simple, mm-hmm. in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. So could you tell us a little bit about how Uber was pitching itself as it launched, and how that may have fueled or shaped middle-class responses to its arrival?
Yeah, so in many ways, the company acted as it acted in many other parts of the world. It launched its services and, you know, left the legal conversation for later. But one of the main messages that they played on in their Buenos Aires launch was, you know, the whole the empowerment, as they do in other places, the drive when you want, get a taxi, get a car when you want. It's about freedom of choice. And it's about, you know, your ability to be entrepreneurial, which was a discourse that was, of course, leveraged in other parts of the world. They also, however, which was a very compelling argument in Buenos Aires, they launched this sustained campaign, particularly through mass media, but also through social media. You know, insisting on, you know, Uber works everywhere in the world. Uber is now working in 400 cities around the world. It's connecting people all over. And in a place like Buenos Aires, you know, we're talking about the wealthy capital of a peripheral country. That argument that something works, you know, everywhere else in the world, even if it's not strictly, you know, true, because Uber wasn't in every single country, but of course, it was working in many places. But an argument that takes that shape is immensely persuasive when received by people who are anxious to belong to that modernity. And it's persuasive in and of itself, regardless of its truth value, right? So that was one of the most interesting drivers. And another one that was quite particular to Buenos Aires is that, to my knowledge, the Buenos Aires version of the Uber conflict, as opposed to the Uber conflicts that happened elsewhere, took a particular form because the judge told the company they should interrupt its business and that Uber transactions should be blocked, and the company refused to cooperate. So that turned what was, you know, a complex problem of, you know, what kinds of relations are we seeing here, into something that came quite close to contempt of court in a way. And because, so as the court started saying, you know, we have problems, you know, we have to determine what Uber is and how it's affecting the order of things, Uber launched a social media campaign saying that they would defend people's rights to choose with a hashtag and everything, hashtag right to choose, right? So we're talking again, that right to choose is a moral right. It's not necessarily a political right. You know, the right to choose is not necessarily spelled out in constitutions. It's, you know, it's part and parcel of how we inhabit late capitalism, but it's much more raw as well, and it has an immense traction, and that was particularly salient in the case of Buenos Aires and its local version of the conflict, because again, it made it harder to argue against it. It made it harder to think of disagreement, I insist, beyond academic seminars, right? In the actual life of the conflict, it became harder to engage people who were so frustrated with not being able to access a service that was allegedly working in 400 cities of the world.
So in the sixth chapter, you unpack the middle class logics further, and you focus on this phrase, ordered, orderly order. And this framing, you point out, rests on a grammar of efficiency, supply, and demand that is set to overhaul and revolutionize mobility and movement within Buenos Aires. You posit that Uber works, in fact, as a phantasmagoria for the middle-class publics. And I would love for you to say a little bit about how Uber works as a phantasmagoria. And what does this do to the notion of inclusivity in and of transportation?
So I took when I was trying to figure out how to understand the way in which these middle classes were understanding Uber rides, one of the things that struck me was that Uber was producing for them, because of course before Uber arrived, there were no other such platforms in Buenos Aires. There were only taxis. So, of course, Uber brought to the city a new way of sorting out movement and of imagining what movement is made of, in a way. Not in an exotic or, you know, or utopian way, in the concreteness of, you know, a technological innovation that the city didn't have until then. And what really struck me is that when I was trying to engage my interlocutors from the middle class that were using Uber, downloading Uber, driving for Uber, people quite eagerly took on the language of demand, supply, price multipliers. People were discussing what the algorithm did, not necessarily because they knew the algorithm itself, because as is well known, Uber's algorithms are quite secretive, but because they were evoking this efficiency implicit in the notion of algorithm at the level of common discourse, right? So then, you know, I had all my interlocutors talking about, well, you know, supply, demand, and such. And then I started thinking about these people are understanding their relations, not as relations, not as social relations. This is a classical Marxist argument. Not as relations between people, but as relations between things, right? Between abstractions, between supply and demand, that they're matching each other, between price surges, between market clearance and these things. And it reminded me of the Phantasmagoria. So the Phantasmagoria was a device, a pretty amazing device, actually, developed a couple of hundred years ago as a similar to the magic shows. But it was what was particular about the Phantasmagoria was that spectators or the audience never saw the source of light. It was a dark room, and all they could see were forms, ghosts, shapes of light flickering around them and moving in quick succession without them having a way to actually sort of know what they were made of or what was behind those shapes. That's where Marx took the notion of, saying this is a phantasmagorical relation, not between people, but between things. And that's when I started thinking about the problem with the phantasmagoria in my case is not necessarily that these relationships were not real or were contrived or were cynical or were, you know, whatever we may say about how Uber organizes its trade. But what's interesting is that these relations work through what I would call propositions. That is to say, they present users, drivers or passengers with prices, with rides, with journeys, with moments of time that are actually that can manage a language of efficiency without being verifiable, right? Because when you're interacting with the platform, you know, you can't really know if that's an optimal journey or if that is a quote unquote market price. You either take the price or you don't take the price, right? You ride or you wait or you take something else, right? So it creates a sort of order made of all these phantoms that actually it stops mattering whether these phantoms are actually quote unquote real or if they're fake. But what starts mattering is that people start thinking in the terms of the phantasmagoria. In other words, one of the most salient examples were the cars that Uber shows on its screen, you know, when you're a passenger and it shows cars around you. And so this fieldwork was conducted in 2016, and already Alex Rosenblatt, one of the main researchers or earliest researchers of platforms, and in particular Uber, had argued that many of these cars were not real. They were not actually cars that were out there, but they were, you know, ghost cars. And so I asked one of my interlocutors, are these cars real? But the problem is that people don't care if they're real, right? Because when my interlocutor told me, well, you know, that's by the way, whether it's real or not, the point is that the platform will find the car. So that ghost, in a way, is standing there for something else that may or may not be there. But it's generating, it's allowing people to think in terms of that ride, in terms of scarcity, in terms of, you know, surplus demand and such. And what was interesting about that phantasmagoria is that in principle, it can include anyone, you know, because there's no reason why, you know, the barriers of entry, you know, back to the point of inclusivity, it can include anyone as a driver. It can include anyone or virtually anyone as a passenger. And every single experience counts, right? So as is known, Uber has the 5 stars to rate drivers. But these are used by, you know, private users, who then rank their or rate their experience. I should clarify that back at the time, there was no way for drivers to rate passengers. At that time, it was unilateral. And then, of course, you know, there's this sense of, again, this sense of empowerment, this sense of democracy, because now everyone can pronounce themselves on, you know, the quality of the ride or how good the ride was or how bad it was or whether there were problems with it or on virtually anything, right? And that's when I started thinking about, you know, thinking in terms of, as we said earlier, the politics of knowledge when it came to taxis. You know, there were actual questions. Can this person tell red from green? Can this person hear? Has this person had a heart attack? Has this person got any of these diseases that would make them more likely to have an accident? Right? As we said earlier, these were public politics of knowledge, right? That were playing on a public sphere of, you know, discourses of, you know, medical knowledge, of physiological knowledge, and so on. Whereas here, you know, these five stars are so inclusive because you can rate on a basis of absolutely anything that, but they're both, they're very inclusive, but they're also private. In other words, I rate with respect to how I felt, and that's the only thing that matters. But because nothing else can matter, my, you know, say I give four stars because the driver was too chatty, then, you know, later on that day, you give that driver four stars because he was a reckless driver. Then later on that same day, someone gives four stars because he had terrible music selection. Right? These are all fundamentally different things. They're not even problems. I mean, being a reckless driver is possibly illegal. Having bad music is irritating. You know, these are not things that are remotely comparable. Yet they get, you know, in that sort of empowering inclusivity or inclusiveness, they get aggregated arithmetically to produce a rating that cannot mean anything. Epistemologically, is fundamentally empty, but that carries with it the illusion of infinite inclusivity, where knowledge cannot be ranked, right? This is private knowledge, in a way, or private experiences that have colonized a public problem. In other words, we can disagree whether one needs to know if a driver can tell red from green. You know, there's something to disagree with at the level of the taxi, right? Whereas now with all these ratings, there's nothing to disagree with because they can't actually mean anything.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's super interesting, yeah. And I was just thinking about I have seen people rate drivers, or I myself have rated drivers, and it makes a lot of sense. So in the seventh chapter, you write about how while the taxi industry initiated legal action against Uber, Uber kept going with discounts and used, as you just also mentioned, the concept of freedom of choice to continue its operations. But you do delve into how the legal system sought to regulate Uber. So what were the sorts of legal regulations that were attempted, and what were the predominant consequences of legal action?
So it was a tricky problem from the outset because Uber arrived when it decided it was a good time to arrive. And the justice found out that they had not sought any particular permit. They had not sought a permit to trade. To trade period, they had not sought permission to trade as providers of transportation. And so the arguments began in a way similar to those debates that were had at the time elsewhere in the world about the nature of these relationships. That is to say, is this an innovation, therefore something that is beyond the remit of laws that exist and that are based on previous cases? Or is this in fact simply a reworking of things that we already know, and this should be held to the same standards as other forms of transportation. However, part of the difficulty was that the difficulty that justice had was because they struggled technically to pin Uber down, right? The sort of amongst that segment of the middle class started developing the sense that somehow Uber was beyond jurisdictions. which was in a way a corollary of Uber's own claims. But unfortunately, for a couple of things that I will mention right now, the way things played out made it, you know, lent that argument a legitimacy that maybe it didn't deserve. Because one of the first attempts that the justice, you know, we need to remember we're talking about, you know, street fights, raids on law offices, raids on the at the CEO's, Uber CEO's house in downtown Buenos Aires. And as all of these things are happening, the justice is figuring out, right, where are Uber offices, where are Uber transactions, who is taking part in them. And when the company refused to shut down its services and explain itself, you know, the justice took on more sort of a more, I don't want to say aggressive, a more, what's the word I'm looking for? a more enthusiastic, more decisive stance, yes. And one of the first things that the justice attempted was to block Uber transactions. And so they had technicians that told them, well, you know, they happen, you know, through internet in this way and this other way. And so the justice said, well, you know, we should block the transactions for the entire city of Buenos Aires. And now the problem was that Buenos Aires, there's a few cities in the world with a similar makeup. The most famous one is Washington, D.C., which is integrated to Virginia and Maryland. And, you know, the separation is mostly, in many ways, ceremonial. It's just, you know, a line on a map. In the case of Buenos Aires, although the city of Buenos Aires is its own jurisdiction, the border between the city and the province, which is the next jurisdiction, is simply a highway and the river at the bottom. But the internet infrastructure serving the entire area is completely integrated. In other words, you know, to keep the story short, it was politically, it was, it made perfect sense that the judge from the city of Buenos Aires would ban or carry out its authority within the strict territory of the city of Buenos Aires. Technically, however, in the literal technical terms, this was impractical. It was just not possible to shut down Uber for one side of an avenue and keep it going for the other side. And this was the first big difficulty that justice had, because on the one hand, it lent credence to Uber's argument that it was beyond the law. And on the other hand, it made the justice look recalcitrant, provincial, and as if they had misunderstood what was at stake. And then again, you know, the next attempt was to block transactions at the level of credit cards. And that ban, to a degree, succeeded, but then credit card companies couldn't tell necessarily where the transaction was coming from within the city or from beyond the border, because, of course, Uber's platform serves the entire metropolitan area, which spills over the city borders. They also couldn't tell whether the transaction was even happening was coming from Buenos Aires or from, say, Uruguay, which is across the river. And of course, you know, there is a way of knowing, but the companies have no incentive, but Uber has no incentive to tell. And finally, the companies found it easier, some of the companies, to just pay the credit card companies, to just pay whatever sanction the justice would give them for not complying, rather than enacting costly and technically contorted bans. And so this rhetoric of, you know, being beyond the law gained more and more traction and made it harder to politicize the company's presence, because it kept, in a way, quote unquote, winning the popular argument by it being so hard to get rid of it, right? So from the justice perspective, it was always, you know, a legal and political problem. There was no intrinsic difficulty at a political level. However, the technical difficulties in effectively stopping Uber transactions made it very hard for one to challenge the notion that Uber was beyond the things that it was effectively superseding.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, that I think was very comprehensive, and really, I think the book is such a fantastic example of like pulling together different, I guess, perspectives on the same, you know, the clash, but like really each chapter kind of drawing or pulling at a different thread. And I think that is that's what I loved about the book. And I'm very deeply inspired for my own book to really try and bring out all these different sides to the story as effectively as you did. But, you know, I've taken up a lot of your time already, and this has been such a great conversation, and I've like relived the book as you've been speaking, but I would not want to let you go without asking you what you're working on right now and what can we hope to read by you in the nearish future.
Right now, I'm working on behavioral economists. In other words, I mean, this may be already known by the audiences, but is this branch of economics that's combining psychological insights, sociological insights, neurosciences and other sort of sciences to try to figure out how people actually act in particular contexts. And this is being used in governmental levels, particularly in the UK, and particularly during the last 2 years, so during the pandemic years, to try to nudge people to take certain decisions to the extent that these people are known as the nudge unit. So at the moment, I'm working on, again, always with a foot on the economic side of things, trying to understand how this version of economics is shaping public policy and shaping how we understand relationships between citizens and the state, relationships between citizens and companies, between companies and the state, and so on and so forth.
Very, very interesting. Yeah, that sounds like a wonderful new project. Well, thank you, Juan, for taking time out to chat with me today. I really look forward to reading more of your work and more of this newer work. And congratulations again on this fantastic book. I really wish you all the luck with it. And I'm sure it'll be immensely helpful for people who do pick it up and read it. So, yeah.
Yes, thank you, Sneha. Thank you so much for the opportunity to discuss it. I mean, it was a fun project. It was a scary project, and thank you for taking the time to read it. And I hope, as you say, I hope it helps bring ideas to others.
Yeah, thank you.